Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. The Good Place is the place you go when you score enough points on Earth for good behavior to reach your idyllic reward in the next life. At least that's according to the acclaimed NBC show of the same name. But how is good defined? Can people change their nature? What if The Good Place isn't all that good? Such are the questions posed by the comedy series, which stars Kristen Bell and Ted Danson. The series and Danson are up for Emmys on Sunday night, and the show's fourth season? It makes its debut next Thursday. It's the feverish, pastel-colored brainchild of the television writer Michael Schur. He's a driving force behind some of the leading comedies of our age. This hour, On Point, my conversation with Mike Schur about life, philosophy, and The Good Place. Join us. I'm interested to hear what viewers of the show take from it, especially those teachers and students who have studied The Good Place in class. I hear that happens. Why study it? How has it informed your thinking? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org. On the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll be joined by one of the show's stars, Kristen Bell. With me first from NPR West in Culver City, California, is Mike Schur. He's creator of NBC's The Good Place, previously a producer and writer for The Office, co-creator of Parks and Rec. Mike, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I'm delighted you're here. I really enjoy the hell out of the show, I got to say. You produce shows that in some ways have more traditional settings, and we can talk a bit about that later on. But, you know, setting like Dunder Mifflin, a setting like a police station, right? A setting like a local Indiana municipal building. How on earth did you think, I'm going to make this pitch and I'm going to make it about this show, a place, I want to be clear, that starts, you're introduced to a place that is the afterlife, your reward to live in a place designed around your own interests, your own joys, because you've been such a good person.
Yeah, so basically what happened was when Parks and Recreation ended, NBC did something very foolish and told me that they would guarantee whatever I wanted to do next would go on the air for one, at least one season. And that is a rare thing, and it was, I took it very seriously, and I sort of thought, well, I've been writing some version of, you know, a bunch of goofballs in an office for a very long time now. You know, my first job out here was the show The Office, and then after that was Parks and Recreation, and then Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and I could do that again. I felt like I knew how to do that, but if someone says you can do whatever you want, I sort of felt like I owed it to like the concept of ideas to take a big swing. And really what happened was I thought of a bunch of ideas, and then this was the idea that I thought was the best. It was just the one that sort of interested me the most. So, you know, that's the only way I think it makes any sense to make TV or really anything else is to pursue the ideas that you think are the best ones and let the chips fall where they may.
For those listeners who are foolish enough not to have watched this, at all. Let me give them a little taste of how this works, right? So Eleanor Shellstrup is played by Kristen Bell, and she's been rewarded, or so she's told, by getting to live with her eternal soulmate. Her eternal soulmate is a guy named Chidi. He's a professor of ethics and moral philosophy. And in this scene from the first season, Eleanor spies Chidi reading The Metaphysics of Morals, which is written by the German philosopher Immanuel Kant, and Eleanor asks him about it.
A book on how to act good.
Oh, great. So you've decided to help me.
I don't know. There's a thousand questions. Is there a moral imperative to help you? Do I have a greater obligation to my community? Are you taking someone else's spot? Someone who deserves to be here?
Ooh, on that question, I honestly think I was just put here by mistake.
So that's one of the most immediate turns that you have as a viewer is that Kristen Bell, looking beatific, is introduced by Ted Danson to this next phase of her existence, and she realizes she's not supposed to be there at all. Why is that the initial conundrum that you decided to introduce to the scenario? What did
you
do?
The original idea was just what if the afterlife is basically like a computational system that's omniscient and inarguable, you get a certain number of points for good things you do, and you lose a certain number for bad things you do. And, you know, the top, let's say 5% get eternally rewarded, and everybody else, doesn't. And then I thought, well, that's interesting. But the really interesting idea to me was, what if someone got in by mistake? So someone, you arrive in a place that's clearly reserved for the very, very, very best people who ever lived. And then you look around and very quickly realize, oh, yeah, this is a mistake. I'm not supposed to be here. So that was the sort of that was the initial idea, was what happens to a person like that who finds out very quickly that also if the alternative for where she is really bad. She asks, there's a character in the show named Janet who is sort of AI, or she's not a robot, she's not quite a god, but she knows everything about everything. And Eleanor asks her, tell me what's going on in the bad place right now. And Janet plays an audio file of like a live audio stream of what's going on down there. And it really sounds bad. So Eleanor basically realizes she has to hide in plain sight. So she asks her soulmate, or the person who is intended to be the soulmate of someone with her name, can you help me learn how to be a good person so maybe I can earn my spot here? And suffice to say, she is not really super into moral philosophy, and it doesn't come easy to her. But that's the sort of that was the opening gambit of the show, was can someone learn how to be good by having a really good teacher and sort of studying the theories of ethics and moral philosophy that that he's well versed in.
Right. So there's others have recounted in that first session, there's an architect named Michael who's sort of the creator of this community designed, sort of bespoke for the people who are entering, right? So
right.
On the point system, remembering sister's birthday, that's plus 15.02 points. Pet a lamb is 0.89 points. Stiffing a waitress, you lose 6.83. Disturbed coral reef with flipper is 53.83 demerits. You know, it goes on from there. I want to play this clip of Ted Danson, who plays the architect, Michael, who's explaining that there's a high bar for admission to the good place. And he describes the ethical point system you're characterizing here that is applied to judge conduct on Earth.
You know how some people pull into the breakdown lane when there's traffic and they think to themselves, ah, who cares? No one's watching. We were watching. Surprise. Anyway, when your time on Earth has ended, we calculate the total value of your life using our perfectly accurate measuring system. Only the people with the very highest scores, the true cream of the crop, get to come here to the good place. What happens to everyone else, you ask? Don't worry about it.
But Eleanor, of course, worries about it very much because she is not supposed to be there at all, as she quickly realizes and concludes. That riff, that was kind of based on your own experience, right? Your own deals with the vagaries of the 405 or whatever you were driving on in L.A.?
Yeah, that's right. There wasn't one genesis for this show, but one of them was that when I drive through LA, which is a terrible way to spend your time, I would be in traffic on a freeway, and someone would do that thing that Ted describes right there, which is pull into the breakdown lane and just whiz past everybody, as if saying, the rules don't apply to me. I'm special. I get to do this. It's usually someone in a fancy car who just has decided that he or she shouldn't have to live by the same rules as everybody else. And I would play this game in my head where I would just say, like, that's negative 18 points. Like, that's negative 14 points, whatever. I would just assign demerits or points to people who did good or bad things. And that was one of the ways that the show sort of took shape for me, was just a sort of general sense of, like, hey, yeah, I know this sucks. Like, I know it stinks to have to sit in traffic, but it's just the deal. Like, you don't get to skip the line just because you feel like you shouldn't have to obey the same rules and laws as everybody else. That kind of thinking really infuriates me and always has. So yeah, that was one of the original kind of points of inspiration for the show, was it would be so great. Wouldn't it be so great if someone were keeping score in that precise a way? And you could almost see visually a negative 15 appear over that Audi that just pulled into the breakdown lane and whizzed past you. That would be so satisfying.
Let's take a call now from Roanoke, Virginia. Damien, thanks. Thanks for listening. What's your question from Michael Shore?
So I just wanted to thank Mike for the work that he does on The Good Place. I'm a philosopher by training. I teach philosophy. I teach science technology studies. I teach religious studies. And I'm a black man in philosophy, which is not exactly a wide occurrence in the United States. And I just wanted to say, having the representation of Chidiana Gagné on TV as a moral philosopher, even as a philosopher who sometimes struggles and overthinks and overcontemplates more than he should, is honestly just quite wonderful to have. And I teach philosophy with pop culture, so being able to point my students to The Good Place, being able to point conference audiences to The Good Place, and have them have an automatic in to philosophy that's also funny and engaging and uplifting and generally hopeful about the nature of the world is honestly just a gift. And I wanted to say thank you, Mike, for that.
Hey, Damien,
I also do a lot of work with AI. So thank you.
Damien, stay with me here. Damien, just very quickly before our break, we've got about 45 seconds left, but how do you use it within your course? How do you call upon it?
So one of the things that I do is when I'm trying to give like examples of, you know, ways to think about quandaries in moral philosophy, or when I think about the implications of actions, I can point to the ways that Eleanor and Chidi and Tahani and Jason all are trying to navigate their lives. And I can kind of point to specific examples of the ways that sometimes, even when you're not necessarily thinking about the contemplation of the world in the way that Jason does, he can still kind of find answers with compassion. And that sometimes compassion and morality have a lot more to do with each other than rationality and perfect thought and morality. And being able to use that and tie that into things like non-Western philosophy, Asian philosophy, mm-hmm. African philosophy is really helpful.
Thank you for that, Damien. We're discussing the Emmy-nominated series, The Good Place, what it means to be a good person, what it takes to craft a comedy that works, even one that includes a dope with a strong and evolved sense of empathy. You can join our conversation. What lessons have you drawn from the first three seasons of Good Place? What do you find distinctive about its approach? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing the acclaimed NBC comedy series The Good Place with the show's creator. The first episode of the show's final season makes its premiere next Thursday. You can join our conversation. How has the calculus of what you look for on a TV entertainment and TV comedy changed over the years? Follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me, Mike Schur, creator of The Good Place and a key force behind the American version of The Office, as well as Parks and Rec and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Later this hour, we'll be joined by Kristen Bell, one of the stars of the show. Mike Schur, you know, it's not just that you devise this scenario, right, where you've got The Good Place, you've got what is clearly the alternative, which is a hellacious punishment for what could be. And the demons are both highly entertaining. I think at one point in hell, if I'm not mistaken, there's an exhibit of toxic masculinity that people are forced to walk through and wander through like the worst museum ever. But it's not just incidentally you've set this up for humorous intent. Like, you are doing real exploration of fundamental things that philosophers have been wrestling through with for generations and centuries. You know, I get that NBC says to you, hey, you've made us a lot of money. We're going to, you know, throw you a line. You can put whatever you want on. You had to do this in a way that worked. How, you know, what made you decide that you could get away with continuing this as a fundamental point of the series, not as just sort of the hook to hang your hat on?
Well, there's a couple answers to that. The first is that I promised them when I was pitching them the show, I kind of understood implicitly that it was a tough sell. And so, you know, when I was, I decided that, to not pitch them the show until I knew what the entire first season was, because I felt like I owed it to them. If they were taking sort of a risk on me, I needed to, I feel like I owed it to them to really explain what the show was going to be. So I didn't commit to writing it until I figured out the entire first season, including, and this is a spoiler, if anyone's out there, if yeah. anyone out there hasn't, isn't, doesn't watch the show, first of all, what are you doing listening
either
to this
Either cover
interview?
Your ears or listen to this raptly and then, you know, make a time machine to go back and watch the first season unknowingly. Go right or ahead like, and spoil your first season, however.
Yeah, go watch the season and then maybe catch this on like the NPR website right. in a couple of years or whatever. But there's a large twist at the end of the first season, which basically upends the entire premise of the show. So, which I won't really go into. But it doesn't matter, because the point is that I felt like I owed it to NBC to explain exactly what I was going to do. And so I laid out the whole – essentially the entire plot of the first season. I didn't actually get all the way to that twist when I pitched it to them, because I wanted to make sure creatively that that was the right move. But I went into great detail about moral philosophy and about like why I thought it was important to the show and how it wasn't just going to be window dressing. It was going to, we were going to really get into some ideas as much as you can in 21 minutes and 30 seconds every week. So I explained that to them, and I said, I promise I won't make it feel like homework. And then like in the third episode, Chidi is literally standing at a blackboard and it says like philosophy 101 on the blackboard. And I was like, oh boy. But you know, you can do things like that when you have a very talented writing staff that writes really funny jokes. And when you have a really amazing group of actors who are really funny and can take these kind of wordy chunks of dialogue, like Will Harper, who plays Chidi, is incredibly good at acting, but also just facile with language. And he was always able to take these meaty chunks of stuff and boil it down and make it sound palatable. Like I think he would be a really good teacher in real life, because he just has a way of being able to communicate these big ideas very simply. So, it became clear to me that moral philosophy and the study of ethics and ethical behavior couldn't just be something we kind of gestured at. It kind of had to be baked into the idea. Like, that was what made the idea special. So we just sort of committed to it and rolled the dice, and it worked out.
So the core of the cast are a fivesome. It seems like a foursome in The Good Place, and that's Eleanor Shellstrop. She's played by Kristen Bell, as I mentioned. Will Harper plays Chidi. Jamila, who's a philosophy professor, but also a guy who agonizes over everything. You have Tahani, right. played by Jamil, who's essentially a socialite who wants to come off as an incredible benefactor of society. And you have Manny Jacinto, I believe it is, plays Jason Mendoza, who is this sort of dope from Jacksonville, who nonetheless has in some ways works through certain kinds of issues of how do you treat people differently, decently. Here's one of the questions they were wrestling with. You took the British philosopher Philippa Foot's trolley problem, which poses this philosophical dilemma, which is rooted in the concept of utilitarianism, which is, of course, the idea that you do the greatest good for the greatest number of people. This is the classic dilemma that crops up in a lot of intro philosophy courses. Chidi stages his own seminar to this group that includes Eleanor.
You are driving a trolley when the brakes fail, and on the track ahead of you are five workmen that you will run over. Now, you can steer to another track, but on that track is one person you would kill instead of the five. What do you do?
Do we know anything about the people? Like, is one of them an ex-boyfriend? Or that snooty girl from Rite Aid who was always silently judging my purchases?
So that's not always the extreme philosophical response to that question. But, you know, you being you, you then torque it a bit, right? You say, okay, it's not just enough that Chidi gets to pose that to the folks. It's the afterlife. Anything can be done. So the architect of the community, Michael, then stages that same dilemma, that same trolley problem, and turns it into a literal and gory moral exercise, turning it on the professor, forcing Chidi to confront the implications of his own lessons.
Oh, God! Michael, what did you do?
I made the trolley problem real so we could see how the ethics would actually play out. There are five workers on this track and one over there. Here are the levers to switch the tracks. Make a choice.
The thing is, I mean, ethically speaking...
No time, dude! Make a decision!
Well, it's tricky! I mean, on the one hand, if you ascribe to a purely utilitarian worldview...
Okay. So, what did we learn?
So, Michael, sure. What did we learn?
Well, what you can't see on the radio is that they just smushed five guys and there's blood splattered all over Chidi's face and torso. That was, as a little context, basically what happens at that point in the show is that Michael is wrestling with his own kind of sense of morality, which he had none because he was a demon. And he is sort of trying to learn about human ethics. And at a certain point, he's sort of not getting any of it. And Chidi says to him, "You just have to trust me. Like, when it comes to this stuff, I know more than you do." And Michael, an immortal demon, sure doesn't like hearing that. And so he lashes out. He is doing that. He's forcing Chidi into that real-life trolley problem sort of as a way to torture him again and to sort of slap him around a little bit, which Chidi doesn't know.
He's torturing him over his sense of indecision, his inability to commit.
That's right, his inability to decide things. And just also just he's torturing him because he's a demon and he, old as he puts it later in the episode, old habits die hard. So to me, it's a perfect – that's a really perfect episode of this show as a representation of the show because – it involves a very specific and famous philosophical idea that is explored somewhat in depth. But ultimately, the sort of solve, the emotional solve of that episode is Eleanor, who doesn't know a ton about moral philosophy, but has a very good sort of antenna for when people are not being straight with her and is very emotionally intelligent. She figures out what Michael's doing and she goes and talks to him and says, like, here's why you're doing this. You're doing this because you're embarrassed and you're lashing out and that's something I used to do when I was embarrassed, and you have to apologize. And so the emotional resolve of that episode doesn't have to do anything about philosophy. It has to do with people relating to each other. And ultimately, the show is really about that more than it's about moral philosophy. It's about how we treat each other. There's a book by a philosopher named T.M. Scanlon called What We Owe to Each Other, and that book crops up over and over again. And that really is ultimately the sort of foundation of the show, is what we owe to each other and how we relate to each other and what rules do we come up with to sort of have to create societies and get along with each other since we don't really have any other choice.
I mean, without undercutting what you say there, it kind of strikes me from watching the show and absorbing it that in some ways that's central to your thinking about life and the human condition, that that's not incidental, the idea of how we treat each other, how we honor one another, how we encounter one another is very much fundamental to sort of your outlook in this. And therefore, that is, in a sense, a philosophical stake for you.
Yeah, right. I don't mean to say that that's not a philosophical idea. Like, there's whole schools of philosophical thought that deal with only that, right? Like, their social contract theory dates back centuries. And it's just about, like, all right, we're all a group of people in some place and we're trying to just get along with each other. What do we do? How do we do this? What are the rules? And that, you know, it's funny because it's something that we don't go, except for that book, What We Owe to Each Other, we haven't talked a lot about that branch of philosophy. We've talked about a lot of other branches of philosophy. But I think that that idea, that sort of social contract theory or that group dynamic stuff, that's just baked in at the very bottom. So we don't talk about the philosophical aspects of that very much because I think it's so basic and foundational to the show. So it strikes me whenever I have conversations like this that if anyone is listening, that this doesn't sound like a comedy. It's like, I promise you, it's a comedy show. There's jokes and people do funny things.
Well, there's all kinds of stuff. Like you have a series of somewhat hilarious and somewhat
terrible puns, right? Like you go into the main square of this the neighborhood, and the restaurants are named things like Ponzu Scheme, the Pesto's Best Yet to Come, and Lasagna right. Come Out Tomorrow. And you know, you find the questions of torture in the Bad Place, right? You know, what songs would demons play to inspire them to uncharted depths of evil? And you answered that by the idea that he plays the beloved 1989 ballad by Richard Marx, Right Here Waiting. Right, like you just say, like that is one of the worst things you can think of to inspire demons to render terrible horrors upon perfectly good people. It's you know you're bringing your own humor to it. It's not they're not exactly dad jokes. They're just fun.
Yeah, one funny aspect of the show has been trying. You know, when you want to use a song, you have to get the permission of the people who wrote the song, right? And so it turns out it's very hard to get permission to use a song when the person says, well, what's the context in which you're using it for? And you have to say, well, it's what demons in hell play to make themselves happy. You know, I really wanted I have a personal bugaboo about the Christmas song, A Wonderful Christmas Time by Paul McCartney. There is no bigger Beatles fan in the world than me. The Beatles are like the essence of my like musical upbringing. I think that's one of the worst songs ever written. I hate it so deeply. And I tried really, really hard to have Wonderful Christmas Time be the only song that's ever played in the Bad Place. And that didn't fly. So there's a lot of funny things that crop up when you're trying to say. And fortunately, Richard Marx has an excellent sense of humor. He's a very funny person. And so we were like, well, can we use a song? And he was like, absolutely. That sounds great. So that's one of the weird side effects of doing a show that has essentially – it's non-denominational. It's not Christian heaven and hell, but it is essentially heaven and hell. You have to have a lot of semi-awkward conversations when you're talking about what happens in hell.
Like to take a call now from Columbia, South Carolina. Jose, thanks for listening. I assume thanks for watching.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to say, excuse me, that thank you for bringing philosophy to the mainstream. I love The Good Place. For the longest time, The Office has been my favorite show, at least for a decade. And now it's kind of, I don't know, The Good Place is right there with it. I graduated with an undergraduate degree in philosophy, and when I was at Texas A&M University, you know, I was president of the philosophy club, and our biggest thing was trying to teach everyone that everyone is a philosopher. That was kind of our mission statement. And finally, there's a show out there in the mainstream that just shows that we all have the kernel of philosophy within us. So thank you for bringing the show. I really love it.
You're welcome. Go Aggies.
Mike Schor, what do you think when you hear that kind of reaction from it, other than wanting to make sure people know it's a comedy? When you hear people talk about it in that way, what does that do for you?
So when the show started, I was fairly realistic, I think, about my goals for it. Like, you know, we had Ted Danson and Kristen Bell, which really helps.
Hard to beat.
You have Ted Danson, it's hard to beat, and you really feel like, okay, this if any show has a fighting chance, it's a show with Ted Danson and Kristen Bell. But I also knew that the subject matter wasn't a super mainstream or whatever you want to call it. And I had this weird thought very early on, which was if show could get to the point where actual philosophers at the high school, college, anywhere in between level are using it, they feel like it's accurate enough and entertaining enough to use it to illustrate actual philosophy when they teach it, then that will be that's a bar of success I wanted to clear. And we have two philosophical advisors, like there's a red phone in the writer's room that we can pick up and get direct line to two actual philosophers who help us like untangle ideas and see, and we can run stuff by them to see if we're accurate. Todd May, who's a professor at Clemson, and Pamela Hieronymy, who's a professor at UCLA. And they do a really good job of saying to us, you know, Pam came in and actually taught us the trolley problem because it's part of her intro class at UCLA. And so they've been very helpful. They've been vital, in fact, to the idea that we're mostly accurate. You know, in a comedy show, sometimes you're going to bend things or sort of cut corners in order to make things funnier or more palatable. But generally speaking, our accuracy owes a lot to them. So that was a big deal, like what Jose just said, that people are actually using the class or the show in their classes to explain these ideas, and they think it's at least accurate enough that they won't, we won't like screw anybody up or misrepresent big ideas. That's wonderful. That really feels like we achieved something.
I also assume that you know, it's something of a cult status. We don't have a ton of time before the end of this segment, but what kind of response have you gotten from your peers who write comedy and who you know, are making their own pitches?
I mean, you know, comedians are weird. Comedy writers are weird, and every time a comedy show is successful, every other comedian or comedy writer, it feels a combination of thrilled and also envious, and I'm including myself in this regard.
Grudging.
That's right. And it's like comedy isn't a zero sum game, right? It's like there's as we can look around the landscape right now, there's 10 million TV shows and half of them are comedies. So, you know,
let me say this. We're discussing the hit comedy, The Good Place, the show's creator, Michael Schur, and with Kristen Bell. She'll be joining us after the break. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Oh, can't you see it, baby? You've got me going crazy. Wherever you go, whatever you do, I will be right here waiting for you. Whatever it takes, or how my heart breaks, I will be right here waiting for you.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're discussing the NBC comedy The Good Place. It's up for an Emmy for Best Comedy on Sunday evening, and its fourth and final season makes its debut next Thursday. You can join our conversation. What questions you have for my guests, let me tell you who they are. With me, Michael Schur. He's creator of The Good Place and other hit shows, including Parks and Rec and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And also joining us from Los Angeles on the line is one of the show's top stars, Kristen Bell. We have a sneak peek of next week's season premiere of The Good Place. In it, the characters Eleanor and the architect and, as it's revealed, Demon Michael introduce a new member to their celestial neighborhood. This new member seems pretty unimpressed.
So you, Linda Johansson, are in the good place.
That's nice.
I know this can be a little overwhelming, but you'll get used to it. Do you have any questions?
Is there a fitness center?
There can be. Plus, literally anything else you could possibly wish for.
Just in case we weren't clear, this is the good place, a state of eternal happiness. Paradise.
That's nice. I like that.
I like that. Kristen Bell, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us today.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Your character, Eleanor Schostrop, is in some ways, you know, the heart of the show. One of the things that's amazing to me, it's so fun. She is so incredibly, particularly at the outset, self-centered. And yet you take us a bit on this journey, the idea that you're I don't know. It seems to me as though you're representing the possibility of human beings to change, which is a central theme of the show. What appealed to you about doing this show and this character on The Good Place?
You know, I've always been really stimulated by playing characters that were sort of inherently unlikable on the page. And Eleanor, you know, in the first few episodes was very unlikable. She didn't have any real redeeming qualities. She was very self-centered. And there's something about a character written like that where my challenge is to figure out a way to get you to root for her or minimally be interested in her until the writers begin to show her redeeming qualities. That in combination with Mike's sort of pedigree and all of his other work, it was just something I was really excited about.
I mean, Eleanor, you know, does things like, there was one thing in the first season I remember where she basically ditches any notion of decency by going to a concert instead of taking care of some obligations that would be really important for other people. She seemingly responds in every instance, not only doing things that help herself, but going out of her way to offend people about things that they care about, whether it's, you know, environmental activism or family members or whatever. You wanted to go with that, right?
Yeah, I did. Well, because I knew what kind of a writer Mike was and what kind of a writer's room he led. And I knew that there was no way that he was going to be let all these loose ends stay untied. And so I knew if they were showing something severe, as, you know, in that situation, I think Eleanor was watching someone's dog and she just leaves open a gigantic bag of dog food and goes to a Rihanna concert instead of staying there for the 3 days she was supposed to watch the dog.
Right.
I knew that what they were doing was showing something that had a little bit of shock value to the audience in order to get them interested, and that slowly over the course of the season and the series, we would peel away this onion and that there would be a lesson and a reveal to say, oh, Eleanor has all this selfish behavior, and it's interesting to watch, but you could get fatigued of that, but they never let you, because right when you were like, oh, Eleanor again, they started to show you why. They showed you how absent her parents were. They showed you how she'd always had to fend for herself. And you then get the entire shape of the character and go, oh, now I kind of see why she just never had a pattern of having to be a team player. She was always left out on her own, and that's why she only thinks about herself.
You know, your character, it seems to me, is sort of trying to make up for what she was supposed to have upon arrival at the good place. And there's, you know, it's almost as though she learned self-awareness there, right? And as though she's trying to live life in a real hurry to try to deserve it after the fact. One of the amazing things about your performance, and, you know, it's a comedy, but, you know, you're able to portray – I think Mike has spoken this before, but I really realized it after reading him say that somewhere, that you're able to portray almost a series of emotions in the same moment because your character is processing so much on, you know, yes, one-liners and stings and people making fun of her, but also, you know, real life points about, God, like, she clearly hasn't thought about this stuff.
I mean, well, first of all, thank you. Look, I'm a very complex person. I've always got a lot of waves right under the surface. And I guess I'm just grateful that some of that transfers into my performances. But yeah, I mean, again, it's so stimulating to me to try to make two things happen at once. It's juggling is my favorite thing to do. So to have someone say something really nasty, but be able to catch a look in their eye that they are either sorry they said it or don't really mean it or are only saying it to protect themselves. Those layers are really fun for me to add. And I think when Eleanor got to the good place, what she was really doing is going through her first five, her early education learning that we do with our toddlers that she should have learned but never did, which is sometimes you have to share your toys. You are not the only person in this household. But when people don't receive that, what happens to them? What pathways do their brains create? What patterns, you know, do they have for the rest of their life? All that stuff is really interesting to me. And the ultimate question, can it change? Can you outweigh bad experiences with good experiences?
You know, some of your colleagues have talked about how Mike leads the show. You talked about the writer's room there. Mike has certainly inspired loyalty from his comedic colleagues. Here's your co-star, Ted Danson. He was on stage at Comic-Con in San Diego back in July speaking about The Good Place creator, Mike Schur.
You can't write about decency and what it means to be a good person and how to lead a life and their consequences unless you truly understand that and lead a life like that. So,
yeah,
it's been an honor that I think, because I've been so busy trying to remember your lines, that will catch up with me as I go through life. You are an inspiration, for real.
That's it.
Mike Schur, Danson prefaced that by saying he was just about to start crying again. How did you approach leading this show as informed by the kind of values you were writing about?
First of all, hi, KB.
Hi, Mike.
You still there?
Yeah,
How did I approach leading the show? Was that the question?
Yeah. I've seen. You know, like your colleagues have talked about that. They it's in some ways like it's affected how they think about, you know, working on a workplace. Some of them have said that, you know, I think Megan, one of your lead writers, has basically said she went vegetarian or as a result of having to process all these issues for week after week in the writer's room. Right, that people are just starting to grapple with things they took for granted.
Well, I think there's sort of two answers to that question. The first is just how you go about the task of just managing people. And to me, Hollywood is a place that not only allows bad behavior, but actually very frequently rewards it. There's a weird thing that happens in Hollywood where if people are mercurial and unpredictable and cruel and behave terribly and keep people at work until 5 a.m. every day, this weird like cult of personality builds up around them. And it's like, oh, that person's a genius, you know, and that's their process is so interesting and whatever. And it's all nonsense. It doesn't have to be that way. It has to be, you have to treat people. My only real goal in terms of management or overseeing any project is to just remember all the time that the people who are working on the show have lives and families and other interests, and they like to go see movies or they like to play with their kids or eat dinner with their husbands and wives and girlfriends and boyfriends and whoever. And my goal is to get them home as quickly as possible. Like, we have to do our work and the work is hard. And occasionally we have to stay a little later and have dinner at the office. But my singular goal all the time is to get everybody home, because it's not, you know, it's fun. The job is fun and work is fun. And it's a job and there's a lot riding on it. And a lot of people are sort of, you know, paying us a lot of money to do it, but it's not everything. And it just can't be everything. It's not healthy for it to be everything. So that's the sort of basic approach of the show. And then this show in particular, we spent all of our time every day talking about ideas that have come out of humans for the last 2,500 years about what it means to be a good person, and every possible nook and cranny of that thought was just thrown out onto a table and chopped up and discussed. And the people I work with are very, very smart, and not just like intellectually smart, but emotionally smart and creatively smart. And we had a lot of wonderful discussions about a lot of wonderful topics about the nature of goodness and what it meant to be, to treat people well and to kind of live in the world in a way that added more good to it than bad. And as a result, yeah, a couple people were like, you know what, I should be a vegetarian. That did happen. But also, you know, we found our behavior, just day-to-day behavior, changing slowly over time. And I think for the better. So it felt like a real gift, I think, to work on a show that we really loved with actors and creative partners like Kristen, who is an absolute dream of a person. Forget about actor. As a person, she's a dream. And we worked with a bunch of those. And also the things that we were discussing and chewing on every day were big, giant, fun ideas about how to make the world a better place, and also a bunch of fart jokes. That was
it's the counterbalance.
That's right. We decided to end the show after the fourth season because it just felt like the right time to do it. It felt like that was the story we wanted to tell was being told properly if we ended it there. Mm-hmm. And it's very sad for a number of reasons, but the number one reason it's sad is just because the process of working on the show, the actual sort of just essence of working on the show with the people we worked on the show with, was so wonderful and fun. And it feels like the best four-year college experience that anybody could hope for, full of friends and interesting classes and discussions and late-night pizza.
Kristen Bell, I heard you laugh when he was talking a little bit about the evolution and the issues there.
I also find it so interesting that Mike's writer's room went through the same metamorphosis that he was seeing if he could prove on the show.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're talking about these big ideas, if you're asking questions, if you're discussing what other people thought, and you're really, like, it feels like trying to get to the root of what it is to be a good person is what makes you a good person.
Or maybe as close as we can get.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that ends up being what the show sort of states. I think that's the show's official position, and that's, we go into that a lot explicitly in season four, that there are a lot of debates about how one might define a good person or a bad person, or a good behavior or a bad behavior. A lot of reasonable people can disagree about things like that, but what the show ends up saying, I think, is that if you're trying, that's what matters. If you're waking up every day and you're thinking, like, it's basically four questions to me. What am I doing? Why am I doing it? Is there something better that I could be doing? And if so, what is it? If you're just asking yourself those questions all the time about whatever it is that you're doing, big or small, the act of asking those questions and putting that in the front of your mind instead of the back of your mind is the thing that makes people better. I really believe that. And that's the sort of that's the closing argument, I would say, of the show in the fourth season, is that it's less important whether you can look at something and say you're good or you're bad, which in this world that we live in now is a very frequently engaged in activity, right? Everyone is looking around and saying, this is good, that's bad. It's all binary. And what's more important, I think, is that you're trying. And the ironic story of this is when I first met with Pamela Hieronymi, the UCLA professor who came on as an advisor, I explained what I wanted the show to be. And she said, well, you can't do that. It's impossible. And I said, why? And she said, because most philosophers would say that you can't try to be good, that it's impossible to try to be good, and that just doesn't work. And I immediately was in over my head. And I was like, well, did anyone say that you could try to be good? And she was like, well, I guess sort of Aristotle. And I was like, great, that's my guy. Love it. Aristotle, I'm putting all my hopes on that guy.
Backwards so, engineering to the guys at the beginning of this debate.
That's right. So we ended up being a sort of Aristotelian show at its essence, because he believed that being good was something you practice, like practicing the flute. You can just practice and do good things and be around virtuous people and sort of absorb their actions like a sponge, and that will make you a better person.
Kristen Bell, I'm going to give you the last word. We got about 40 seconds left. Could you have done this show without getting, like, really invested in the idea of the ideas? Could you have done this as just an acting job?
No, definitely not. But I also feel like it came at a time in my life when I needed it, because I am crazily preoccupied with what it means to be a good person. So Mike gave me sort of the best 4 years of therapy and everything I was interested in, as well as having the best day job I could ever imagine.
Therapy, college, a hell of a good time. The Good Place enjoys the premiere of the first episode of its fourth and last season next Thursday, September 26th. The show's creator, Michael Schur, has been joined us this hour. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks too very much to Kristen Bell. She's the Golden Globe nominated actor and star of The Good Place. Thanks for joining us as well today.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point, it's produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Dow, Mylene Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Pulley, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from Sharif Campbell, Jeffrey Lyon, David Marino, and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. It feels like the good place around here. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.